This is Barry Tyker of the University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project. Today is May 11th, the year 2004. I'm with Frank Gentry, again in the basement in the archives of Memorial Library. And we're going to continue the discussion we began yesterday about Frank's career. Frank, yesterday we started on the three-legged stool with teaching. Today we're going to move to research and then to service. Let's talk a little bit about research. When you came to Madison, you joined the German department, how much was research stressed?
Oh, very much so. But one thing about Madison that I have found then and find now, still 25 years or more later, almost 30, is that Madison is an experienced university. The German department is an experienced department. So they have realistic goals, and non-experienced places, where I've also served, do not. And that means, yes, we want research and we want quality research, but they identify research here at Madison, at any rate, in terms of quality and not in terms of quantity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
And maybe what I got tenure on, the amount of research I had when I got tenure here, would not have gotten me tenure at SUNY Albany,
lesser place. Yeah.
But they paid attention here to the letters that colleagues wrote, and we had smart colleagues, or I had smart colleagues myself, and they would read. I mean, they actually read the material that I wrote, and they had a whole. They took the whole picture into consideration. Mm-hmm. So I've always found Madison, and I followed the careers of people who were here and after me, and who are very distinguished, I think, and very good in scholarship, and younger than me, and yet they would not have gotten tenure at other places, I know, and that would have been, and that's stupid. And Madison's great in that regard.
And you also had the advantage, did you not, of having these smart colleagues to toss things off of.
Absolutely, and who would encourage you and mentor
sit
you
down
in
for
a way.
Lunch. Well, that was my next question. Yeah. Were there any, did you get a little bit mentoring early on? You talked about Yost and a couple of people talking to you about different things.
Well, basically it was, as I mentioned yesterday,
it would be
Yost
informal.
And Reinhold.
Yeah,
it was always
Reinhold,
informal.
Yeah.
There was no formal setup. Yeah. And that was fine because I work better that way. And I think lots of people do that, the idea that I have to meet with my mentor.
Yeah, right.
It's like meeting with your dissertation advisor.
Yeah, it does sort of carry that to the next step, doesn't it?
I was very fortunate. And other colleagues who were not, let's say, of the same, at that point in their careers, of the same caliber as Yost or experience as Yost and Reinhold, I'm thinking of David Bathrick and Klaus Berghahn, who's still here in the department. They were very encouraging, and we were sort of the younger ones, and we could talk with each other, and they were both, they knew enough about my area that they that I could have good conversations about my area with them. So I have no complaints about
that. So you had the big people, and you also had sort of your
the little people, make the big people great.
Yeah. The little people had their little talks about little things.
It was truly, in one sense, it sounds corny, it sounds like something you'd hear at a fundraising dinner, but it really was, and probably still is, a community of scholars. And the real interesting thing, each one of us took our teaching seriously. Klaus Berghahn, just to use one example, because he's still here, he taught a full load. Yost and Reinhold were teaching reduced loads because of professorships, their named professorships. He taught a full load, which was five courses a year, and published an enormous amount and good stuff. He was a good teacher, or is a good teacher, was involved in service. I mean, that to me is the Madison idea.
Yeah.
And you don't find that elsewhere necessarily.
And again, that's something that becomes part of the culture of the department, is it not?
Absolutely.
If teaching is really stressed.
It's stressed.
It's
not
going
lip
to be
service.
Stressed.
No lip service. Yeah.
What about funding for your research? How did you get funding initially, and how did that change over the years, or did it change over the years?
Here at Madison, the funding possibilities for people in the humanities are very good, I think, compared with other places where they're non-existent. I'm talking about internal in-house mm-hmm. funding, and specifically the research committee, the Graduate mm-hmm. School Research Committee. And that's where I got most of my funding from. Summer salary, which was very neat, you know, helpful mm-hmm. In the early days especially. Salaries were not very high mm-hmm. here compared with other places. And I got a couple of fellowships, the Humboldt, Alexander mm-hmm. von Humboldt Fellowship, and where I spent 2 years in Germany, in which is what really got me tenure, I would say. It gave me time mm-hmm. off. The department let me go mm-hmm. for that amount of time, and I got an awful lot of work done over there, made good contacts. And when I came back, that's when they put me up for tenure. Mm. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And I let's talk about those fellowships for just a second. Mm-hmm. You had a research in the humanities, Institute for Research in Humanities
yes,
fellowship
did, yeah.
in 77,
right.
and then the von Humboldt fellowship in 78, 79, and the summer of 82.
Right.
Talk a little bit about your Institute for Research in the Humanities, and if you want to say anything about the institute itself, this might be an appropriate place to. I don't know how involved you were with it.
Well, at that time, I was just an untenured faculty mm-hmm. member, and was very grateful to get this mm-hmm. Internal support. It gave me a semester off, mm-hmm. but I was able to couple it then with the Humboldt, mm-hmm. which started in January of 78, mm. and then I kept it through all of 78 and into 79. Mm-hmm. So I came back in September 79. And my project was basically the same for both terms, and that was the early Middle High German mm-hmm. religious literature. It sounds dreadful, but mm-hmm. it's actually quite mm-hmm. interesting. And I researched, I started doing my basic research here in Madison, mm-hmm. and then in Germany continued mm-hmm. with it in the reading. We're talking about 90 or so works of early Middle High German, which is linguistic, which I'd say is roughly from 1050 to 1160, mm-hmm. something like that. And they vary in length from maybe 20 lines to, you know, a couple of thousand or 4,000, 5,000 lines. And they're of different types. They're linguistically difficult, much more difficult mm-hmm. than, let's say, high medieval German. And it's a field that was not and still has not been adequately researched. But I enjoy it,
yeah.
and I just mm-hmm. Sat there and did that for,
that's great.
For a couple of years. Now, the Institute, that's an interesting point that you bring up, and maybe we want to talk about that under service.
Okay.
I was on the review committee for the Institute.
That's right. You were one of your committees was... okay, let's save that for service. The Alexander von Humboldt Fellowship, it's mm-hmm. something I never heard of until I started looking into your
oh, really?
Background.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where does that...
That's a German from the German government. And that that fellowship it existed before World War II, and then of course mm-hmm. broke off,
right.
and was reinstituted after World War II, and specifically for at one point for Americans, mm-hmm. you know, in the early years, and then mm-hmm. for every now it's open to everybody, mm-hmm. And actually it is there to thank the Americans for their help mm-hmm. in getting Germany back on its feet. Humboldt, the people who go mainly on Humboldt's are natural scientists. Hmm. There aren't that many, let's say, humanists or social scientists. There are enough. But among the humanists, there are very few Germanists who go.
Interesting. So,
because they figure, you know, you can go on a Fulbright or something mm-hmm. like that. But Humboldt is, to my way of thinking, the most humane of all of these fellowships. You cannot really, at least at my stage in my career at that time, could not really have gotten a Humboldt unless I had a mentor in Germany, mm-hmm. their mm-hmm. Colleague. And I was very fortunate. We talked earlier yesterday about serendipitous...
Yes, right.
Well, let me give you a serendipity or two.
Okay.
It's very difficult to get a Humboldt. It's more difficult to get a Humboldt if you're in German, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. for obvious reasons. They'd rather give it to
right.
other people. Reinhold Grimm, whom we've talked about, was at one time a reader mm. of projects for the Humboldt Committee. And so he, you know, he knew how to, you know, how I could phrase my, you need help in phrasing mm-hmm. these things. It turned out that semester, two people were on campus, two Germans, who were very influential, and both personally and professionally. One I've mentioned was Karl Bosl, B-O-S-L, the German historian. He just happened to be a guest professor in the history department that year. Excuse me. Another was Hugo Steger, who was a guest professor in the German department. And both had contacts, or had had contacts, not at that point, with the Humboldt Foundation. Mm-hmm. They were readers. And both wrote letters of recommendation for me. Mm. You know, and I'm not so modest that I won't say that's the only reason I got it, mm-hmm. and because I don't think it is. I think mm-hmm. my project was worthwhile. But I think I might have had a much harder time.
It didn't hurt.
It didn't hurt at all.
Right.
And this is, yes, when we talked, you mentioned one looks back and all of a sudden one sees a whole progression of really important people in one's life. And just how these three individuals happened to be at the same place at the same time when, and that I knew them. I mean, Steger, I knew, my God, what was that? In 1964, I was a student in his classes when he was a young professor in Kiel, Germany. We didn't know each other, but I was a student, but when he came, I said, you know, I was here, and he said, oh, you were in my class, and I said, yeah, and all of a sudden, a really good friendship developed, which still exists, and so it's remarkable.
Yeah, isn't it something how the stars just align sometimes, and you go forward.
Oh, and with the Humboldt, then, that they pay, I mean, it's a generous fellowship, less so for humanists than for natural scientists, but that's the way life is, but still very good. For example, when I came back, I needed some books, and they gave me money to buy in German books. I mean, it was just, it wasn't only monetary, it was also, you were made to feel as though you really were contributing something
Isn't that nice?
To the rise of Western civilization.
A humane granting funding, funding agency, rather?
Absolutely, yeah. Once you're in, then you're in. Yeah. You're never out. I still get every few months magagazines.
That's terrific.
Christmas gift from them.
That's terrific. Yeah. So you were able to hook onto that, and that really sounds
that
like
that made
it was
the difference. I would have to say, seriously, you'll laugh, but I would say Boston Latin School, right?
Yeah.
Made the big difference for the beginning. And the Humboldt made the next big difference.
Yeah.
Absolutely, those are the two major events.
That's great. Okay, your research. You were talking yesterday how it took two real. Directions.
Yes.
You want to say. Do you want to talk a little bit about how define each of those and talk a little bit about it, focusing on your years at UW? We can get into it.
Sure.
I'm sure you carried it over to Penn. We can talk about that.
Penn State.
Penn State. I'm sorry. Yes.
We have a terrible inferiority complex. Well, when I came to Wisconsin, I did research primarily on the Nibelungenlied, so in heroic epic.
Right.
And we talked about that yesterday. But then I became very interested in early Middle High German religious poetry, and specifically to view it against its historical and social setting, which had never been done.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still working on that.
Well, if it was never done, there's probably a whole lot of.
There's a whole lot to do, and I'm glad to say I really was a pioneer in that, even in among Germans, and in this country, only my students, a few of my students, have taken up the torch and are working on it. Early Middle High German is very interesting for the simple reason that it's religious poetry. And people, especially in the United States, when they hear the word religious, they think different things.
Mm-hmm.
But as I would always remind my students, that at that time the church was the only game in town. Mm-hmm. And the church, at least in theory, not in practice, I mean that's something quite different, had a finely developed and very, what they would say nowadays, progressive social theory.
Mm-hmm.
specifically for the people in lower positions. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't only, you know, well, you suffer now, but you'll do well mm-hmm. in heaven type of thing. That was there, clearly. Mm-hmm. But there were other aspects, and specifically admonishments to nobility.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. It was there. And it isn't so, let's say, obscure that you can't see it if you read it, but if you don't expect to find it, or indeed don't want to find it, then you'll never see mm-hmm. these things. Well, anyway, I worked on that and still do. The other direction that my research has taken, which is quite a bit more fun in mm-hmm. one sense, is called the Reception of the Middle Ages of Medieval Literature in Modern Times, mm-hmm. or it's known also as medievalism.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like King Arthur in the 19th mm-hmm. century and mm-hmm. that. In my first work, we talked about it yesterday, was this paper I did for the Wisconsin Workshop on festivals
right.
in the 19th century.
Right.
And I found that I really liked that, and I was getting a bit more, an echo mm-hmm. from overseas.
This is the one that Joost and Reinhardt
right,
got you
right,
involved in.
Right,
right,
right.
Okay.
And then I met a very influential colleague, Ulrich Müller, and that's M-U-E-L-L-E-R, from Salzburg. And I forget now how I actually got into touch with him. Well, it's a long story, so I won't. But I got into touch with him through an intermediary. And he is the pioneer of reception studies in Germany, and he's in Austria, actually. And yes, I had sent him through this intermediary an article about medieval studies in the United States, mm-hmm. which he published. And it turned out then that my wife and I were going over to Germany for a while, and he said, oh, if you're here, come and give a lecture and, you know, tell us about medievalism, mm-hmm. or the medieval studies programs in the United States. And so I did, and I lectured to the crew, and it was not a small audience, which was nice, about other things, about programs in this country and that, including our own at Madison, mm-hmm. but also about Kalamazoo,
mm-hmm.
which is
right.
the big medieval conference
That's
of the year.
That's so interesting.
Yeah,
yes.
3,000 of us just, you know, doing strange things. he didn't want to believe that there was something that large, and so he came over the next year. And he's been coming over 24 years after, and he brings his own students. He brings lots of colleagues with him. So there's been all of a sudden a really fruitful interchange between Americans and Germans. Well, that led to other tasks. Let's say one of which I rather enjoyed. I gave a lecture in Berlin on the reception of the Middle Ages in American film. And it was, and also I tried to view the way the Middle Ages were depicted as an expression of contemporary American ideology,
mm-hmm.
and that worked pretty well. I mean, there were so many films, so I discussed primarily the two types of King Arthur films
mm-hmm.
and Robin Hood films. And what's funny, without going into enormously great detail, is that films up until John Kennedy portrayed the Middle Ages as a sort of beautiful, optimistic, whole society in which the poor were taken care of or were able to fight for their rights, let's say Robin Hood, that type of thing. And after Kennedy's assassination, the Middle Ages, became a period, yes, what we would call, you know, the Dark Ages. It's mm-hmm. dangerous, mm-hmm. right? It's dirty, it's unpredictable. And even the film Camelot,
mm-hmm.
right? I saw the original Broadway play. In fact, I saw it in Boston, the very first performance anywhere in the world of the play, and it was so different with all the color. It was a long thing. And it was just gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And okay, so it's not realistic.
Right.
Who cares?
But Camelot. It's Camelot.
Yeah, right.
Right.
And, you know, Camelot was associated with Kennedy's, and that was
Presidency,
his favorite play
yeah.
and all that. So the play was beautiful. I don't know if you ever saw the film.
I'm sure I did at one point, but I just can't.
And the film was quite different. Stress there was not the sort of beauty and optimism, but it was sort of the depression and the disappointment that was going to come. the brilliant colors of the play, I'm granted, you know, garish, but nonetheless brilliant, were all changed in the film to sort of earth tones. Yeah, yeah, and the director, I remember an interview in which he said, yes, he did this deliberately. He didn't say why. Yeah. He said, I did it deliberately, changed everything from reds and greens to muted colors. And it's funny, you start off, the play starts off and it progresses chronologically. The film starts off with the end, where Arthur now is a king, and it's just before his battle, right? His final battle, going to do battle against Lancelot, right? And then the story, as we know it from the play, is told in retrospect. And that's written, you can't tell me that's just by accident. Yeah. Or Robin Hood, you have the wonderful Robin Hood films, and, you know, fighting...
Errol Flynn.
The film Robin and Marian, from what, the mid 70s. I don't know if you saw that. It's worth seeing with Sean Connery and Audrey Hepburn.
Well, their blows to are always worth seeing.
Yeah. And there, he's killed, she kills him at the end. I mean, be out to spare him. I mean, it's sort of more painful death. But it was this type of thing. Robin Hood is middle-aged and tired and out of shape, and King Richard has been revealed as a terrible, bestial man who would slit open pregnant women's stomachs to see if they had swallowed any jewels, and I mean, all these things are told. It was all very brutal, and none of the optimism, none of the joy, what realistic or it makes no difference. But it's all gone. It's all gone. And anyway, that's part of my reception.
Is that part? This may be pushing the things a little too far, but the way they would portray the Middle Ages, is that sort of allegorical to how we feel about our own society?
That's what I came up with at any rate. That before this Kennedy, where Kennedy was killed by someone from. By one of us, not by someone else, and that all of a sudden, we began to doubt ourselves.
Yeah. Well, so we kind of died a little bit too in that.
I mean, and then of course moving right into Vietnam. I mean, this whole period. I mean,
that was the change. Yeah, it started with Kennedy, and then Kennedy, and then King. I remember that I was in college. And
absolutely.
One horrible thing that after you couldn't believe other. Happened yeah. after the yeah. other. That is truly fascinating. Can we go to Kalamazoo for just a moment?
Okay.
You said this person has been coming from Austria, has been coming for 24 consecutive years now. Tell me just a little bit about what this meeting is about and the kind of the way it's run. I'm really interested in that. I think people listening to this will be also.
Kalamazoo, it's at Western Michigan University. That started out, I believe, in 1962. It was a professor in the Medieval Institute there who organized small meetings, you know, maybe with 20 people, 30 people, and they'd get together for a weekend and discuss medieval topics. This began to develop into a larger meeting by the early 70s. I've been going more or less regularly since 72. And what you would have then are separate sections. You would have reflecting subject areas. And you would have... you'd have religious studies, Cistercian studies, Dominican studies, whatever, medieval history, and occasionally, in the early 70s, a German paper. I would give one, and a couple of other people might give one, but there was no German presence, really. From the 80s on, after Merleau started coming, and a whole group of us from younger people from this country started going, we all of a sudden had 4 to 6 sections dealing with specific German topics. It grew... It has grown now from, let's say, an average of 1,200 people attending to over 3,000 people attending. We have, I don't know how many sections they had, 500, 600 sections, something like that. Yeah, so lots of parallel sections and reflecting all possible subject areas within medieval studies. And within each subject area, all possible permutations with gender studies and newer theoretical approaches, it's It's great, and what makes it really great is not that you meet your old friends again. That's nice, but it's not a hiring convention. Mm-hmm, it's not like an MLA, let's say. Yeah, you know, where everyone is sort of trying to parade and be
that meat market.
Yeah, right. And we bring our grad students, and so you have a lot of young people, middle-aged and older people, but there's a wonderful mixture mm-hmm. that the graduate students are encouraged, almost like our mm-hmm. little chicks, you know, saying, you know, let's give your first paper. Mm-hmm. And most times, not always, but most times the papers are good. Mm-hmm. And I think for instilling a sense of professionalism and a mm-hmm. sense of belonging, Kalamazoo plays a role that cannot be overestimated.
That's terrific.
For example, most of us there do not have positions as the medievalist in a graduate program, mm-hmm. right? Whereas everyone was trained to be that, you know, with their PhD, if mm-hmm. they went through mm-hmm. and became, and I'm not talking only about German, but especially about mm-hmm. English mm-hmm. and that. And so most of them end up as teachers in a college curriculum, mm-hmm. right, where they maybe never offer a meaningful mm-hmm. course or once every few years. But this recharges their batteries.
This is interest-driven.
Yeah,
so
precisely. Yeah. And they mm-hmm. participate. Because what a waste. You have all these people who've been mm-hmm. trained and some very bright people mm-hmm. out there who say, oh, geez, there's nothing, I can't mm-hmm. do anything. And then we've seen colleagues mm-hmm. who get lazy. Mm-hmm. And but not these people.
That's great.
It's a wonderful thing.
In terms of studies of Middle Ages, you've been in this area for a long time now. Over time, has interest in the Middle Ages let's talk about the Middle Ages in general.
Yes.
Has it waxed or has it waned? How has that gone over time?
That's an interesting question. It started waxing in the 60s, and it reached, in my opinion, its peak around in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. Chris Kleinhans, who was still at this university, and I mentioned him yesterday, he's mm-hmm. a Dante right. scholar. He and I published a book together called Medieval Studies in North America, mm-hmm. and that was in the early mm-hmm. 80s. And at that time, we were on the crest of the wave. There was great interest in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. lots of students wanting to study it. And interesting new directions in research being opened up, which mm-hmm. instead of the, for us in philology, mm-hmm. in the philologies, instead of the standard look at the text and, but don't look at anything mm-hmm. else right. type of thing. Well, reality caught up with this enthusiasm. And
reality in terms of jobs.
Jobs. That I think I mentioned yesterday, my last student, Scott Pinchakowski, that was in the mid-90s, and he was the last one I accepted because I couldn't guarantee I could find them a job. I mean, I can't understand colleagues who accept students for dissertation mm. And then, you know, that's just another item in their vita.
Right.
And you've got to work your fingers to the bone to help your students, if they deserve it, and if they don't, you shouldn't have accepted them, get a job. Mm-hmm. And then if they follow through, to help them mm-hmm. keep it. I mean, that's a full-time job, as you know. Anyway, I've had three or four people since then saying, can we write? And, mm-hmm. and I'd say no, yeah. and I'd tell them why.
Right.
Not because I didn't like them, but... right now, we're not in a good position in German, certainly, mm-hmm. for people who want to find a job.
Yeah, we talked about
studies.
That, right?
Yeah.
Oh, medieval studies, yeah.
Yeah. So I would say that things are waning. In fact, I just published an article on the history of medieval German literary research in the United States mm-hmm. from the beginnings to the present. And that appeared in a volume published by MLA called German Studies mm-hmm. in the United States. And just came out, and I addressed this problem, but only looking at it from the German point of view, that there are no jobs, departments. If a medievalist leaves, a senior medievalist leaves, even one who has done something with his or her career, it's not being replaced.
Yeah, one of those fields, kind of a frill.
Yeah,
I think
precisely.
They're called frills, yeah.
First Baroque, 16th, 17th century, and that went, and then now medieval goes. So I don't know if it will change. Not yet.
You said that there was the waxing in the 60s to 80s, mm-hmm. and was that primarily because of the jobs, or was it this resurrection?
That's great. You're asking me all the right mm-hmm. questions. That I think it had to do with Kennedy.
Yeah, there we go again.
This idea of Camelot. I mean,
I was going to say, could it really be Camelot?
Yeah. Yeah. It started the boom. It just did. And then Tolkien.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Became very, very popular in this country. People nowadays in the year 2004 think, well, that's just now, but no. Younger kids. Yeah. And that really sort of fueled the desire for fantasy, mm-hmm. if you will, for your reality. Mm-hmm. But I'm convinced it started with Kennedy.
I'm going to give a personal anecdote here, mm-hmm. which I usually don't do, but I read The Fellowship of the Ring when I was a graduate student. I read it on the bus. I had rather a long bus ride, and I had to stop because I kept missing my stop.
Yeah.
You kind of get engrossed in that thing, and all of a sudden,
absolutely.
My goodness, that was a mile. Yeah.
Put a whole bunch of matches here, and there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Just a couple of general questions. What do you consider to be your most important publication or publications?
Okay. I would say the most important recent publication, and I would say probably career publication, is a book I edited and also wrote an 80-page chapter in called Companion to Middle High German Literature to the 14th century. Hmm. And the title is terribly forbidding, but I asked people, every one of whom I know, except for one, to write chapters, and all in my sort of age group, mm-hmm. so 50 to 60, and asked them to, I said, all right, we all know enough now
mm-hmm, right.
to do this, because a literary history is a difficult thing to write. And I said, write what you know, never mind writing what's in the other literary histories. Write what really is important about your area, whether it's, I did the early Middle High German, or whether it's mysticism or courtly love lyric mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. like that. And I think we have a pretty decent volume mm-hmm. out, and I'm quite proud of it. Every essay, and essays were of different lengths. Mm-hmm. As I said, mine was about 80 printed pages, and others were maybe 15 printed pages. Mm-hmm. It all depended on the topic, mm-hmm. and so I'm pleased. That's not my life's work, mm-hmm. but,
well,
but nonetheless,
that's
nice.
Field,
I think it is. Yeah. I think I'm surprised that my dissertation is still being read, and that's what I published then, mm-hmm. revised. It's my first book. It's still being read now, and is still being quoted, and most times not saying, if the idiot only knew. But I guess, all right, let me tell you what work we haven't talked about, but I'm proud of it. I mean, I'm trying to sort through it. Isn't that I've done so much, but I'm sorting through. It's also an early work, and it's also a paper I delivered at a Wisconsin workshop. But this time it was primarily, they let me stay in the Middle Ages instead mm-hmm. of in the modern period. And it was on the concept of work in the Middle Ages. What did work mean? Labor. Mm. And I went through from about the 5th to the 16th century or 15th mm-hmm. century. And I got letters from all over Germany, but not here, of course, telling me that I thought this was really good,
that's
a contribution,
yeah.
And I was proud of that. Mm-hmm. That is, whether it's a contribution or not, I don't know, because mm-hmm. no one else does anything mm-hmm. on it. I think the work I've done in early Middle High has been a contribution. I did a bibliography that was published in, I think, late 80s, that the first comprehensive bibliography of all the 90-plus works mm-hmm. in the Middle Ages, and it took me over 10 years to mm-hmm. put together. Mm-hmm. But which, and for that, I might add, going back to an earlier question of yours, for which I had great support from the graduate committee here, mm. the graduate school research committee, with the TA or a research assistant in that. So I would say, and because of my work in the early Middle High, and this is also a contribution, three of my students have taken up the early, middle, high. In other words, have done more specialized studies on their own, all of which have been published, and now they're teaching. That's right. And that's why I consider that a contribution, that's a big contribution.
To the field, yeah. Exactly. Another kind of a generalist question here, talking about developments in your field of study.
Yes.
That's, we've talked a lot about it nationally and internationally.
Yes.
Describe what you might consider the most significant change or the most significant changes that have taken place conceptually, methodologically, introduction of computers, things like that.
Oh,
is there anything that jumps out at you?
Oh, quite a bit, actually. I find, and this is the shame that there are no jobs available and that interest then for that reason is waning.
Yeah, that's
I find that the areas of possible research now, also in German, in medieval literature, let's say, are just fascinating. I mean, this is an interesting time to be doing medieval studies. You have gender research, research in the body, you know, people, but none of that is dangerous, right? None of that does away with all existing interpretations. If you look at women characters, for example, or if you say, is there such a thing as queering the Middle Ages? It's, you know, you may agree or disagree, but the work, and I've worked with the body somewhat too, and with women, that it doesn't do away with what we know. It doesn't do away with certain truths about a text, but it enhances. It gives you another viewpoint.
More
more perspective, precisely. And these colleagues who are so hidebound, you know, if you mention women in literature, they, you know, the eyes fly open and all that. I mean, it's just stupid. It's so interesting. And if you, it's too bad. I could have, had I known, I would have brought a copy of the program of Kalamazoo, just that would show you body and gender and this.
Well, I'll look it up on the internet. I'm sure.
Yes,
I can find
it's on the internet. Yeah, and it's really, it. So this type of thing that. As the field grows, as opportunities in the field grow smaller, the opportunities for research in the field.
Isn't that interesting?
It's fascinating. Yeah. It's fascinating. You know, that for years it would be, let's say, in German, you know, forgetting, you know, my loyalty and friendship, which was a little, went just a little bit beyond the usual at that time, but not a whole heck of a lot. It was just, you know, looking, all right, Parzival, you know, this type of thing. It wasn't a. There were no interesting studies when you look at
that whole worldview of the time.
And so, and you have this also reflected in historical studies and cultural studies. I would say the whole cultural dimension has been added, and that's wonderful.
Yeah, that's great.
Just wonderful. Oh.
Can I ask my one silly question?
Sure.
I'm allowed one silly question. Any comments on Monty Python's interpretation of the?
Love it. I took that in my, I had incorporated his Holy Grail, Monty Python and the Holy Grail into my article on film as the sort of the culmination of the of the Arthurian legend.
When it gets to that point,
there's nothing, I mean, that's another thing too, that you have so many colleagues and one doesn't laugh. Probably his vision, Monty Python's vision of the Middle Ages was a lot closer to reality than anything else we've seen.
Interesting.
I mean, you know that comment where King Arthur goes by with his they had what, coconuts, they were pretending they were galloping.
Right.
And you have Eric Idle up to his knees in mud and that, and as a peasant.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, there goes the king. And he says, how do you know he's a king? He said, he ain't covered with shit.
If people are listening to this in 50 years, you might try to find a historical, whatever DVDs are called, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. It will be worth your...
it's really funny. Yeah. Okay, sorry.
Any other comments on your research?
No.
Okay.
No,
let's move to service.
Ongoing.
Faculty governance is a really important or much talked about concept here at the university. In your experiences at the university, how did you view, was faculty governance truly an important concept that was worked at consciously by the university, and to what result? Were you ever on the faculty senate? And
Oh, yeah.
Talk a little bit about faculty governance.
I think when you're a faculty member, you must realize this, that you take all this talk about faculty governance with a grain of salt and say, I'm sure, right, But when you get involved in faculty governance at the UW, you realize that obviously you don't have all the responsibility, but you have an awful lot of responsibility. And I can tell you at the UW, much more than at SUNY Albany, where I was certainly as a younger man and inexperienced, or at Penn State, where I am now and not so inexperienced. Faculty here have a lot to say, but if they want to say something, they have to do the work, right? If, what is it, you have to walk the walk.
Yeah, whatever, right. You have to talk and walk the walk.
Right. And for whatever reason, I have sort of a liking, maybe even an aptitude for administration in certain respects. And I was a member of the Faculty Senate, which I will say was not an arduous task. Right. And we talked yesterday about the TA committee. Right. Which was an arduous task.
Yes, it was.
But I was also a member of the Graduate School Research Committee, which was fabulous. I loved that. And you know, you get a good feeling. You're doing something. And really, you are doing something. Yeah. It isn't some dean sitting there saying, fine, you want to give so-and-so that. But I don't think so. Yeah. I think we'll do this.
Well, why don't you just explain in 20 seconds exactly what your job was at the, for people who might not be familiar with the Graduate Research Committee. The
Graduate School Research Committee administers funds which have, as far as I know, been garnered from patents that the university holds. We call it the rat poison.
The warfarin money.
And the Research Committee of the Graduate School actually consists of two subcommittees, one dealing with sciences and the other dealing with social sciences and humanities. And of course, I was a member of that. Yeah. I was chosen by the Associate Dean for the Humanities, again, one of these individuals who just happened to be there, Edwin Black, who was from Communication Arts. And you had a, what you do, it's probably the most hardworking standing committee I've ever served on or have ever heard about. You are given as a, faculty members are allowed to apply for all sorts of grants, grants in aid, assistance, summer salaries, semester salaries, that type of thing. And there are forms they fill out, there are projects that they have to hand in, project descriptions. These then are divvied up among the colleagues on the research committee. Now I, as someone from the German department, would probably get literature or art, I'd get something in humanities, but certainly not German. And I wouldn't be allowed to vote or discuss during the German things. All right. We have these generally 30 to 40 dossiers. I then would go and interview, make arrangements to interview each one of these individuals. I would read some off prints if they had any to offer. I'd discuss their project with them and ask questions so that I had a, to make sure I had a clear idea of what it was they wanted to do. And then you are expected to come back to the committee and report. Now, and you do it all at once, your whole crew at once. We started, let's say we had a month off to do our interviews. And then for, let's say, the 2 months or so of the rest of the semester, we met every Wednesday afternoon for about 4 hours, 4 to 5 hours, and every Saturday morning, in which we each reported on our people. And it, but it didn't stop there, because we were expected to, if we didn't understand something, to question what it was. In other words, well, what did he mean or she mean when she said that? And to, and you had better be able
you
to
had
answer.
Better be able, right.
Because these are people's careers to some regard that you're dealing with. So it was very hard work. It truly was. But you know what you found out? Just how many smart people. There were all on campus.
It's wonderful. And how many good ideas.
And also how, and there were, you know, you hate to say it, but some people can be charlatans too, or at least a project can be a fake project. But you learn how to, and if you don't know, then some of your, one or at least one of your colleagues on the research committee would know. Oh, and then a vote is taken. Yes, mm-hmm. do we and want to give this done, individual yeah. money? And that's either yes or mm-hmm. no. And if there's any dickering to be done, namely, all right, maybe not a, let's say, $10,000, maybe $7,500 mm-hmm. right. or something, that's done then.
Yeah.
So you as the referee know exactly mm-hmm. what the your charge is going to receive.
So you're essentially you have experience of collegiality working with all these people
incredible.
From different fields.
Incredible.
And then you also get to look at other people's work.
Right.
So you yeah. really get a twin benefit in terms of
yes.
Yes.
Yeah. You don't get anything else.
Yeah. Well.
But that's really quite spectacular. Yeah. In a
you don't get any Wednesday afternoons. That's
no,
for sure.
Yeah. But it's great. Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
So faculty governance is alive and well.
Oh,
it was alive
so.
And well while you were here.
I certainly think, yeah. think so, yeah.
Great. We talked about some of your committees, the LNS Academic Planning Committee. You talked a little bit about the Max Cotta Institute. Am I pronouncing that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we talked, you may want to say a little bit more about that. You were on the executive committee of that, no? Let's talk about the Humanities Research Institute then. We pushed that back to this part of the...
One of the interesting aspects of the Institute for Research in the Humanities was that it offered fellowships, competitive fellowships for scholars mm-hmm. from outside the university, but it also had internal fellowships, generally, but not always, for so-called younger mm-hmm. Scholars who could take a semester off and spend it there mm-hmm. without... without teaching responsibilities. And I was, as we mentioned earlier, a beneficiary of that. One problem, as I saw it, with the, even when I was just a kid there, was that it was rather hidebound. You had very interesting mm-hmm. older men, mainly, mm-hmm. sitting there, but it didn't seem to be, I'm not trying to be unnice, but they didn't seem to be doing very much. Mm-hmm. They did their own stuff, mm-hmm. but somehow... For me, the Institute became a place where I just went.
Mm-hmm.
A problem was, as we later determined, the idea of lifetime appointments is not necessarily a good idea for this type of thing. It's a sinecure then, and people just sort of sit there, they sit in their department and say, oh, I don't have to take this, mm-hmm. and I'll go to the mm-hmm. Institute. And there was no incentive to really profile yourself as an institute.
Yeah.
So years later, I was on the what was it called? It was a committee to assess the institute.
Yeah, I don't have official name yeah. here. It was just called
evaluation.
The Humanities Research Institute Committee is
yeah.
what you had on your CV.
And it was the standard committee where departments mm-hmm. are evaluated, mm-hmm. and I was on the Classics Committee one and mm-hmm. the English Department one, which I chaired. But the Institute, this Institute Committee, where you go around, you interview the faculty members involved, mm-hmm. the staff, you make assessments. And we really, I think that was one of the best committees we came up with. And Dave, that was still under, I think, Dave Cronin, mm-hmm. I'm not sure now. And we suggested that they get rid of this concept of lifetime appointments.
Hmm.
I mean, the people who were there, obviously the colleagues who were there, would stay there
right.
until they retired. But new appointments would be on a term basis only.
And but, this is as a way of...
Right, so you get more people involved. All of a sudden, one individual is there, let's say from Classics or whatever, and mm-hmm. no one else mm-hmm. ever mm-hmm. can be there to do some really concentrated long-term research.
Gotcha,
okay.
yeah.
So, and that was accepted by the dean. I mean, the fellows didn't like mm-hmm. it very much, which I understand. But nonetheless, I think, and also that the responsibilities would be, the director would be there also for 5 years, but because that's a lot of work, and I'm assuming it's the same way now, he would get an extra year tossed on as a sixth year where he had no administrative responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And each fellow, toward the end of their term of 5 years, would be expected to put on a symposium.
Mm.
in their field of research.
Mm-hmm.
And I find we found that was a good idea, mm-hmm. we found that it was keeping, and that it would make mm-hmm. this more, it would give it more profile
yeah.
on campus, and I'm assuming it has.
Did they have the brown bags lunches at
oh,
that
yes.
point in time?
Yes, yeah.
I did one of those once. That was a while back.
Yeah. I mean, I think the idea was wonderful, yeah. And I think in a simpler age when only gentlemen were involved, it was probably a great thing. But it's and the fellows, the older fellows, there's the permanent fellows. Really, they were conscientious. Yeah, they came to the lunches, and if you had questions, that you could talk to them. But there wasn't much movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's a good idea.
So the pot needed to be stirred a little bit.
It really needed to be stirred a lot.
You guys
we stirred
a couple good. Anything else on committees?
I don't know. You'd have to jog my memory.
Well, I picked out the ones that seem to be the most important, and you've already discussed them. So this is perhaps not at the exact place I would have put it in the outline had I known a little bit more about the direction we were taking. But one of the interesting things that you were involved in was the Medieval Studies program, and you were chair of the program from 86 to 89. And you actually hosted a national convention here. Could you talk a little bit about the committee and a little bit about the whole convention and how the planning happened?
Medieval Studies program here at the UW, I think, is a model for other places. We talked a little bit about
the different people from the different departments who were involved.
And the spirit of cooperation is still there. And basically, the job of the director of the committee or the of the program is not very arduous. It's normally you just or which courses are we going to do, and let's keep some sort of collegial contact with people. I'm not putting down the directors because that is an extra thing for which you get absolutely nothing. At least you didn't know course release, no nothing. What made my term more interesting was that the Medieval Academy of America had agreed to host, or that had agreed to let us host its annual meeting here in, when was that, 89. And since I was director of the program, I had to come up with something. And that's a great honor, by the way. The Medieval Academy is the premier organization that represents all medievalists, not just Germans, obviously. And Chris Kleinhans, my good friend, and also more or less the other director of the program, we split up the task. He dealt more with how do you, where the program, what the program would look like, and what directions, what research directions would be stressed. For example, you would come, I forget what it is now, but there were like four major topics we came up with. Let's say the court in the 12th century.
Themes.
And so people would submit papers based on those topics. I took care of the more practical business of where is it all going to take place, correspondence, and hotel, all that sort of stuff.
Oh boy, that's
receptions.
Fun.
But it worked out real well. I mean, we had 300-400 people that came in, and Madison can put on a very good show when
it wants to,
and it was just grand. It was the weather cooperated, the lake was great, and the people felt welcome. Yeah. They felt they liked the program. The lectures were good. The plenaries. I just insisted on a couple of things that I wanted some German representation because we tend to get neglected to get the great picture. And we got a wonderful scholar from England, D.H. Green, a very famous scholar. He agreed to come and give a plenary, plus I wanted women's studies involved, and we got terrific. I don't know if you ever heard of her. She wrote Jesus's Mother, Carolyn Bynum. She's a distinguished professor at Princeton now. Or Columbia, one of the two. She's been at both, and I don't know exactly where she is now. But she came, and I was reminded by colleagues this time at Kalamazoo. They said, "Do you remember?" And they mentioned names that I won't mention, of the very distinguished male colleagues who were saying, "What, a woman?" Talking about women's things. So I had a little input into the sort of the program.
So those things were growing in that way.
Absolutely.
Just like
this
everything
would have
else
been the
was.
Right time. Yeah. And as I said, since then it's really been an interesting and fabulous time. But it was, I won't say it was a joy to plan, but it we got good support from also from the rest of the university community, mm-hmm. the support staff. In other words, you have to ask, mm-hmm. how do I do this? Where can I do this? How can we have booze? Can we,
oh, yeah,
can
all
we have
that,
food? And
the logistics.
And it worked out, yeah, the logistics, and it worked mm-hmm. out very well.
Where'd you hold it?
All over. Basically, in the Wisconsin Center mm-hmm. for the individual meetings, mm-hmm. and but we had receptions, and of course, in the Union, and mm-hmm. like where Trim Commons, yeah. And in the Great yeah. Hall, as well as in the Elvehem, and that was very nice. They opened up mm. the Elvehem to a final yeah. reception, and
that's
that was
very nice.
Very
yeah.
nice. Yeah.
You were also involved in other professional organizations. Let me just list a few, and if you want to talk about
okay.
one or none or all of them, that I'll leave that up to you. The International Arthurian Association, the International Courtly Literature Society, the Medieval Society of America, and the Medieval Association of the Middle West, of the Midwest. Were there any of those that bear special
well,
mention?
For all of them, I'm just a member, let's
yeah.
say. Except the Medieval Association of the Midwest, I was president, I don't remember when, quite honestly. And that organization is still continuing, but basically that was just the Big Ten and other associated colleges. Mm-hmm. I have nothing really.
So it's just
yeah.
more of the types of things you've been talking
right.
about, just professional. I was surprised at how many of these organizations
uh-huh.
there are.
Oh yeah, there's quite a few.
Yeah, you know, I was on campus during the 1989 Medieval Studies
uh-huh.
Program Conference, and I remember seeing things in the newspaper, and
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
all,
yeah.
But that's about as far as it goes. And then when I started going over your material
uh-huh.
the other day, I was really surprised at how much stuff,
yeah.
and genuinely excited about it. I think it
really?
Sounds
wow.
it sounds really very nice, very interesting. Honors and awards. You were awarded the Seal of the Universitat Freiburg in
right.
1985. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, that's just, it was a very nice thing. I have had a long association with Freiburg. I taught there. I hosted the...
yeah, you have been there several times.
Yeah.
That came up several times in
that's
your
right.
CV.
That's right. I directed the junior year in Freiburg program
yeah.
there, and which was a wonderful experience. A lot of work, but a wonderful mm-hmm. experience, where I also got stuck with doing an anniversary, 25 years mm. of Freiburg, of this junior year in Freiburg. And the seal was just a symbol of appreciation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a...
So
well,
it's
I'm
a,
happy.
It's
I'm
just
pleased.
An appreciation
yeah.
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 for spending a lot of time
yeah.
doing a lot of work.
And I was the... there's no good translation, so in the Vita I simply say guest professor mm-hmm. at Freiburg, but basically what it was that I took over the chair of the rector of Freiburg,
mm-hmm.
who was a medievalist. And so for one semester, I was invited to
mm-hmm.
take over his
mm-hmm.
responsibilities as a mm-hmm. professor. And that's pretty neat.
Yeah, that is pretty neat.
pretty
yeah.
neat, yeah. So you had an American teaching Germans, middle high German,
oh,
which was
great.
Kind of fun.
That's
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
Any other awards or honors that you that were passed
no,
on?
I mean, just a couple of things, but
yeah.
nothing important, yeah. Yeah. yeah.
Okay. You left Madison University in 1991 to continue your career at Penn State University. Do you want to talk about why you left Madison and what was waiting for you at Penn State?
I left Madison for a series of reasons, I guess. One of which was that I was just coming off my term as chair of the German
mm-hmm.
department here. And I could have been reelected for another year. That was the, if you remember,
yesterday
we talked about
that. Right, that you explained the rules on that.
But I found I really enjoyed being chair, and yesterday I thought I had sort of an aptitude for
mm-hmm.
it. And I thought, why don't I continue on in administration
mm-hmm.
of sorts? And I had been nominated as an associate dean here for a couple of things, and nothing turned of it, and I thought, you know, that door was closed.
Mm-hmm.
So I found this advertisement for head of department at Penn State, and Penn State's an interesting place. You just know the name, but you're quite unsure what
right.
else is there. It turns out that a few colleagues, one from the department and...
colleagues?
In German.
Here or?
One colleague from our department here and colleagues from other departments,
okay.
German departments in the country,
okay.
nominated me for
oh.
this. And in fact, they had sent me a letter asking would I be interested, and I said, sure. And I was it interviewed by phone because I wasn't going to MLA, mm-hmm. and you know, it was sort of snotty about it, I guess. But then they invited me out there for an interview, and it was one of these four-day marathons. And I must say, Penn State puts on a very good show, mm-hmm. too. I don't know if you've ever been there.
No, I've never been there.
They have an inn on campus called the Nittany Lion, which is mm-hmm. a beautiful mm-hmm. place. I mean, it's old, mm-hmm. And it's a nice campus. And that. And I recognized that the department was one that was in trouble. It was sort of asleep. Nothing much had happened mm-hmm. in many, many years. And I got the feeling, though, from the dean and anyone else I met, plus other department heads, that they really wanted change, mm-hmm. that they really wanted to wake it up. They wanted to, you know, have the graduate program mm-hmm. revised and revamped, and it was a real challenge. I mean, I knew that.
Now, the deans and everybody understood that. Did the department understand that
well? That was... I okay. thought they did.
Okay.
Okay.
Proceed.
you know what's happening. But no, I really thought that they did. Yeah. And I think a few people did, but I never understood, or I totally underestimated the powerful pull of lethargy,
mm-hmm. inertia, or something
yeah,
else.
Right. Isn't it? So anyway, I came back here, and Don Crawford was dean at that time, mm-hmm. and I liked him a lot. Mm-hmm. I worked well with him, and Sarge Bush was the dean
yeah,
for the
Sarge,
humanities.
Yeah.
yeah. And they asked, could they make a counter offer? I got a very generous offer from Penn State. An offer which I might add just put me sort of where the other full professors were at other Big Ten universities.
Yeah, right.
And the problem here, then, this was something Dave Cronin instituted, or maybe his predecessor, and that was that if someone wants to leave or gets an offer and the department wants to retain that person, then they have to come up with half the money.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have involved a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that much, but a lot. I mean, because
yeah.
I knew how much we got like, for our marriage.
Speaking, yeah.
And I think, I never thought that was very fair. I thought it was, yeah, fair to one extent. You have to put some money in to, you know, to not just leave it up to the dean to do everything. I agree with that. But anyway, I said no, but I guess the real reason I left, and I'll be quite honest about it, is that I really did not like the central administration at that time. Mm-hmm. Donna Shalala was chancellor, and those of us in the, let's say, the European area of languages or research were completely left out of things.
Mm-hmm.
People coming were not considered to be important. I mean, where before Irv Shane or someone mm-hmm. would, you know, give some support. I suppose if we had brought the Dalai Lama in, that would have been one thing, you know. And I'm not joking that I once had the very important person from Flanders come in. I had established a writer-in-residence
mm-hmm.
program, Dutch writer-in-residence
mm-hmm.
program. And we had the cultural minister of Flanders come, right?
Mm-hmm.
to announce this program, and Shalala just didn't have the time.
Oh.
You know, and maybe she could give us 15 minutes, and I said, the hell with it. And
mm-hmm.
I told her secretary, that's insulting.
Mm-hmm.
And who came and saved the day was Dave Ward.
Mm.
Yeah.
Who was provost at the time.
Yeah.
yeah,
and I just wish that, you know, I had experienced him as chancellor,
yeah.
and I wouldn't have left. But I just thought, what's the point?
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, and the money, and you know, all of a sudden you're still struggling along. Yeah, I was getting here, you know, I hate to put it like this, but as chairman and someone who had done something with his life and, you know, scholarly, well, I was getting what associate professors
mm-hmm.
were getting elsewhere,
yeah.
you know. And the other full professors in the department weren't getting that much more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't that, you know, that I was just the lowest of on the totem pole,
yeah.
not at all. So I thought there was no respect anymore here for not just me, but what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I left.
Yeah.
And I wasn't the only one I know who left when Shalala was chancellor.
And it was primarily for that?
Yes,
that
I think, it, yeah.
yeah,
I have David Ward been there, or someone else, yeah. or Shane, whom I knew too. But this was not
That's
good.
That's really too bad.
Yeah.
So you went there, and you went there with a mission, and you thought you had a wagon full of people supporting you. How did it go?
Well, one thing you must know about Penn State, they're all very polite. And I'm not used to that from Madison.
Yeah, the German crowd was kind of, they were not afraid to, afraid to say right. that, speak their mind.
And we, I came in and wanted to institute some reforms immediately based on what we did here, and realized quickly, okay, that would be unfair. There were some things we just couldn't do. These were people who hadn't done very much for a while. And then I discovered that some of the older colleagues, or middle-aged, they were older, my age, but old, I considered them older, all of a sudden, yes, they hadn't done much for a while and didn't intend to do much. And, you know, I then got, I must say, a little irritated because I...
So they were content to just kind of live out there, stay there, and continue doing not much.
No. I mean, and of course I won't mention the...
No, we don't.
My colleague, but my first image of one colleague when I walked into his office, and he's in a big easy chair, you know, desk chair, leaning back asleep with his feet on his desk, and I thought, oh, geez, take me now, Lord. But and he's still an associate professor, but and complaining about money and all that. I mean, it's it got a little discouraging. Mm-hmm. The new dean was a political science scholar from Nebraska, and you know, was very supportive and said, "Okay, hire." I made five hires all told in my career there, and I would say that two were all right. One didn't work out. One was a disaster. Two were good. And one I think was good, but the dean didn't think it was good. So, you know, it's about average, I guess, when you make hires. But there was a there were problems, and we were making progress. We were attracting good graduate students all of a sudden, and but the dean is a numbers cruncher. And doesn't understand that two sentences can follow one after the other, and was concerned that the numbers weren't adding up. In other words, many of our students, for example, not all, but or even the majority, but many came from Germany, where they didn't have GRE exams, and so we didn't have GRE scores, and this wasn't good. And I said, but they're bright people, right? Colleagues published, and we had these strategic plans drove me bonkers, that we had to do them in the department. And so colleagues, you know, the newer ones and some of the older ones, you know, who were with the program, were writing articles and books, and, you know, it was, and some of them were writing them in German and publishing them in Germany, and we get back comments like, why don't they write in English? Yeah, I mean, this is an attitude one doesn't deal with very well, or I don't at any rate. And so, and this was totally opposite, the complete opposite of what I had experienced here at the UW, where research was appreciated for its quality, and that if you can't read something in Chinese, you're going to rely on someone you respect who can and say, this is good or this is not so good. And I mean, it's a mentality I just can't deal with very well. And so, and the dean, one thing just as background, at Penn State, it's a system of headship, which is different than chair. The head really does have some authority, but it's still the lackey of the dean. And
so you have more control over the department.
And the budget, right.
Okay.
And there was, and for example, for promotion to full professor, you have to go through the whole process as if the person were coming up for associate. And one person came up shortly after I got there, and I had to write, I had to say yes or no, and I said no. For according to what Penn State wanted, and according to the categories, this individual didn't match it. It was an associate professor, again, one of the very long-term associate professors. And, well, the upshot is I was sued for 5 years. And this is enervating, let me tell you. I mean, I'm not being funny. It was terrible. It was the worst thing I've ever gone through. It affects you personally, your family. Mm. I woke up every morning thinking about this, and this diluted my energies for the program. And I guess what really frustrated me was that, which means made me very upset, was that the afternoon before it was finally to go to trial, the individual withdrew the claim.
Oh, boy.
You know, there was no settlement. There was
nothing.
Yeah, and I ended up with an ulcer, bleeding ulcer, and all that good stuff. So they weren't happy times, but at least I thought the graduate program was going well. Our numbers, certainly, I went to, as you know, the CIC has annual chairs meetings from the various disciplines, and our numbers really stacked up according to the, you know, in comparison with our other sister departments, including the better ones. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had promised the dean when I was hired at Penn State that we were dead last in rankings, that give me 5 years and I could probably bring it up to number six. Mm-hmm. In other words, about in the middle of the pack, which is where I thought we belonged. And we were, by all objective criteria, we were right in the middle, you know, below some Wisconsin, obviously, all that. And I don't know why, all of a sudden, I get a response, or I get summoned to the dean's office with a response to my latest strategic plan, or our latest strategic plan. And in there, and the dean said, oh, I want you to save me the postage, you can read it here. And I'm sitting in front of this individual reading. And first I see that they're conflating the German and Slavic program. Well, okay, I can live with that. I sort of expected that. I mean, it's one way to save some money. Slavic is very small. German was sort of small to mid-sized. Mm-hmm. You know, they had good colleagues. I had no problem with that. Then I read, and I read for the first time, this will be interesting maybe to someone in the future. I read, this was the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. So late November.
In what year was this?
1996.
Okay, mid-90s.
Yeah, 97. I read then on this Tuesday afternoon, among other things, and we're canceling or getting rid of the PhD program in German. And I said, is there any way I can convince you not to do this? And the answer was no. Now, that was the extent of consultation.
Oh my goodness.
Right? So I did what I had to do, and I went to the provost, which of course, in a hierarchical situation, I shouldn't do.
Yeah.
I understand that. And I said, what the heck is this? And I showed 3 months before, so in September, I got a congratulatory note from the dean on the fact that our incoming graduate students were the third strongest in the college as a group, you know, of the 27 departments or whatever.
Oh my goodness.
So anyway.
What did the provost?
Well, the provost, you know, he said, well, let me deal with this. Mm-hmm. This was in November. And I called up Judy Craig here for some advice, and I David Ward, who is chancellor, I said, David, you must help me. And he was good. He said, you know, your dean will go ballistic if I intervene directly, but maybe let me do other things. Then a high school teacher gave me a great strategy, and I recommend this to all future listeners. And I asked colleagues from all over, from distinguished, I know a lot of people from this country only though, to write and say, give reasons why the program shouldn't be closed if they could.
Mm.
So people were writing from Berkeley and Harvard and stuff like that, and Wisconsin. And I said, please send the letter to the provost and to the president, a joint letter, with a copy to the dean.
Mm.
And they did. And so all these letters were coming in, because I knew if they sent it directly to the dean,
so the dean got to read what everybody, what the two top guys were, people were getting.
Well, to make a long story longer, the before Christmas, we were informed that the program would be put on probation.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah, and I was really happy because already in November had appeared, right after this, or late November, early December, had appeared in the college newspaper. Yes, the German program is being cut back, and so black on white, and it will be a strong MA program, and, you know, and it didn't happen. So I was called, summoned to the dean's office 2 days before the new semester, and was told my resignation, my immediate resignation was demanded, and I refused.
My goodness.
And I said, I won't do that. And okay, so we negotiated, and I said, I'm going to resign at the end of this semester as the chair, as head, but you're not going to, the department is wounded. You know, it's 2 days before the beginning of the semester, of the next semester, and I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving the headship. And there were threats in it there, but you know, I was from here. I mean, this was where Wisconsin Dream came in. I respected deans. I'm not afraid of them. And so the dean backed off, and so I, you know, handed in my resignation finally as department head at the end of that semester. And since then, I've been associate director of the Max Cave Institute, which was a sinecure, and that was, I was being, if you want the straight term, bought off, because I could have sued the pants off of that individual for breach of contract and everything else, but I haven't gone through something like that. And, you know, it was a tough experience.
Going back to when you were
sorry to be back.
Oh no no
you
no
can
no.
Erase
this is
if you
no, no this yeah. is this is really very unfortunate. When you were reading those, when you first read about losing the program, why was that done? And why was that program?
Precisely. I don't know. I don't know.
You were,
I asked the dean. I said, yeah, why? Well, the review numbers weren't good. And I said, well, what review numbers? And well, I'll say she, it's a she, you know, went back to in, when was it, in 1990, I think, or 91. So before I came, there was a review of graduate programs. I forget, it's a social science council or something like that does that. A review of graduate programs. And Penn State was, I think, tied with Cincinnati, you know, in the lowest position. But that was then, and the next review hadn't been done until, it wouldn't have been done until 2000, 2001. But this was clearly, there was panic. I mean, you know, why did we get rid of it? Well, we got rid of it because I have the feeling, because there was a lot of, you know, this person, this individual who sued caused a lot of trouble. And I feel that, and I got to say, the disaster hire, I did make a disaster hire, an expensive disaster, but I wasn't the only one in the college.
Well, you're not the first person to ever do that.
That, you know, just was German, the German department was in the news too much, so to speak, over there. But there were, what got me was that there was no consultation beforehand. I mean, how much disrespect can you show to a person? Anyway, so the PhD program is alive and well. And I'm now retired from Penn State.
Now, you ended up working at Penn State through, when did you retire from Penn State?
Excuse me, 2003.
2000, oh, so just very recently. Did you continue doing research and whatnot while you were at Penn State?
Oh, sure.
So you continued along the same vein that you had started at Mass. Right. Now, you mentioned something, I can't remember if it was on tape or off tape. When interviews go for a long time and you talk a lot off tape, it's oftentimes difficult to remember exactly when. But you said you have, you are in a doing something now at Penn State that you really enjoy.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that for a few moments?
There is, I'm an emeritus at Penn State too, and also, and there's a program run by the provost's office called, in the title, I'll wait to hear the title, Distinguished Emeritus Research Teaching Professorships.
Wow.
And the title is great, and it all it means is they don't pay you.
So they give you a nice title instead.
No, what you get is sort of half an office or whatever department can find for you, and you get a certain amount of money to support your research program, which is fine with me.
Yeah.
And the course I elected to teach this year was a freshman seminar. It was really wonderful. About 19 year olds, and we did a topic, the topic of war. and which turned out to be, unfortunately, serendipitous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And we read nothing in German. That was one of the mm-hmm. advantages of the program. I could teach mm-hmm. whatever subject I wanted. We read James Jones's The Thin Red Line,
oh, yeah.
John Hershey's Hiroshima, right. Vonnegut, yeah. Yeah, all that. And they responded very well.
Yeah.
And it was a good experience, good discussion, sometimes better discussions than I've had with graduate students.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Yeah.
And they really worked with me. Mm-hmm. So I will be doing a similar one next year. If just do one a year, that's enough for me now.
And is it going to be on peace? I
mean, it's going to be on Satan and evil.
Ooh, now that should be very interesting.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
So it's not going to be such a heavy topic.
Yeah, well, I guess Buffy the Vampire Slayer isn't a real heavy topic.
Yeah.
As a closing statement, do you have any closing comments you would like to make about your career here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison?
Well, I guess that one thing that I really would like to say for a few things. One is something I mentioned earlier. And that's something that came up in our discussion yesterday. Two is how the presence of certain individuals, whether you know it or not at the time, when you look back in your life and you look back and get the whole picture mm-hmm. of these individuals, it's simply amazing and how lucky mm-hmm. those of us who have had a good right. career and a good life, how lucky we are. I'm redundant, that's okay, I'm a professor, I can mention, is that two major career decisions were made, or events happened. One was that I went to Boston Latin School, mm-hmm. that I had a mother that said, I don't want you to go to the local high school. Okay, and so I went to Boston Latin, which forever mm-hmm. changed me. And the second was many, many years later when I got the Humboldt Fellowship mm-hmm. to Germany. Now, in each of these events, individuals were involved, my mother being one, mm-hmm. obviously, and then these individuals I mentioned, Stege, Bozel, mm-hmm. Grimm, and I'm just very grateful mm-hmm. to all of these people. And in Germany, I met some older professors who are now all dead, but they were sort of at the very end of their careers, but these were names to mm-hmm. me, mm-hmm. that, giants, and they took time to talk to me, to encourage me, mm-hmm. even if they thought I was, not as deep as mm-hmm. they were. But it was just wonderful. And then I came to, I was at Wisconsin, and obviously there were problems here and, dissatisfactions. Mm-hmm. This was before Shalala, let's say. Mm-hmm. But, salary was a real problem at this place. Mm-hmm. And certainly the difficulties with the graduate students I could have done without those strikes. But I noticed here, and I noticed it yesterday when I went to a reception here, talking to some people I had, hadn't seen for many years, the absolute collegiality, the support, the interest in what you're doing that goes beyond the sort of polite mm-hmm. Rotary Club type mm-hmm, of thing, mm-hmm. how nice to see you, and I'll move on, a cocktail party conversation. I've never felt in one sense so good as a colleague, as a teacher, as a researcher, as I have at Wisconsin. I've been at three universities, mm-hmm. and not to put Penn State down, there are many good aspects mm-hmm. about Penn State. Certainly it's not the College of Liberal Arts. No, I shouldn't say But this is a wonderful place. And I mentioned yesterday Dave Krohn, and of course we all had, the dean. He always becomes a focal point, right. The dean, yeah? But he was so supportive and open. And okay, you had to make your arguments, you get nothing for nothing. And it was wonderful, yeah. And I found it wonderful to work with every single one of them. obviously I would come home and tear my hair out, which is why I'm bald now, but nonetheless, there were times when I realized just how necessary each of those people were, mm-hmm. and how supportive they were. When I was chair, and Don Crawford became chair here, Don Crawford, who was dean then, mm-hmm. knew that it was a fractious department, and there had been these splits left over from the, you know, the problem with Charlotte Brancaforte, mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. the TA strike and mm-hmm. all that. And he said, you know, if you want, I'll come to your department, to your first department meeting, and sort of, you know, talk. And I said, okay.
Wow.
Which was really nice. And he and Sarge Bush showed up and yeah. really gave a pep talk and yeah. how glad they were to, you know, looking mm-hmm. forward and working with me and all that. And it was nice.
Yeah.
And it also sort of helped establish some boundaries yeah. for the people in the department. I know, as I mentioned earlier, I consider my 3 years as department chair to have been good years. Lots of hard work, but very good years, and I would say successful. And of course, the grass is always greener. That's yeah. the other thing I wanted to say. But I experienced too, I must say, in Penn State, good things
mm-hmm.
That I would not have experienced here. Not so much in research or that, but to an extent maybe, but in personal, you know, contacts mm-hmm. in Germany, new people you mm-hmm. would meet that I never would have
right.
met here. So it's, you know, it's alive. Anything else you'd like
to say? I think that this is a good place to,
okay.
to say.
Before I babble goodbye. Too much. Yeah.
We're back on for just a few minutes. One of the things, issues that... Frank was talking about a little earlier that I failed to follow up on is the whole concept of strategic plans. That's become kind of a buzzword in higher education, I suspect, in lots of other places right now, too. Do you want to talk about strategic plans at Wisconsin as opposed to strategic plans as you experienced them at Penn State?
Yes. When I arrived at Penn State in the summer, July of 91, that's when I began.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 12-year appointment or a 12-month appointment. I was confronted with the necessity of putting together a strategic mm-hmm. plan, and I must confess I didn't know what that
mm-hmm.
was because we had not been doing them
mm-hmm.
at Wisconsin. And I received sort of very general and vague information, and I had to get the colleagues together or do it myself, which is what it turned up out
mm-hmm.
being. What are our plans? Well, it was all very, I don't know, very nebulous,
mm-hmm,
what
mm-hmm.
was expected. It seemed a lot of quantifiable information was being demanded.
Mm-hmm.
The standards of how many faculty and how many hours do you teach and that type of thing, that's fine. But then how many articles were published
mm-hmm.
and how many books and how many this and how many that and where
mm-hmm.
were they published. And then the part I didn't find it very useful,
mm-hmm.
that first plan. Where did I see the department's strengths and weaknesses? I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's okay, that
mm-hmm.
you can
mm-hmm.
deal with. But then I found that these plans were given to a committee of department heads,
mm-hmm.
other department heads from the college, who were going to then comment on each plan that they had. And I don't know if you know about the system of headship, but it's even worse than as a chair, because the heads, they're little czars,
mm-hmm.
and they really, there is territory involved.
Mm-hmm.
So questions would come back to me after this first plan. Well, what does this mean? You know, German,
mm-hmm.
anything dealing with not something non-American was totally unknown to them,
mm-hmm.
dare I say alien.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but I got a pass, basically. It was my first year,
mm-hmm.
and what higher... But I don't think it's a good idea for faculty and staff of the department to make them up. I don't know what it...
Yeah.
It all becomes sort of a numbers game,
mm-hmm.
and you have people comparing, well, my numbers are
yeah.
bigger than your numbers.
So, the focus is not on what...
No. And I think, going back to when our program was almost terminated... That our numbers?
You thought that the numbers were different from the numbers in other programs?
Yeah, they probably were, because we have Germans in the department
mm-hmm.
who do not publish in English, yeah. do not publish, oh, that was one that thing was, I forgot, yeah. excuse me. Each department was required to submit a list to the dean, a list of the top-tier journals in their field, and top-tier presses. And when we say top-tier, we mean American presses. Mm. Oxford and Cambridge are okay, yeah. too. Yeah, I mean, but this is the type right. of thinking. And I would always compare that with the UW, where top-tier, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. If you publish something and it's recognized as being useful and good, yeah. then we didn't care. I mean, obviously, if it was a referee journal, then it was
well,
okay.
Well, it's a German department, for crying out loud.
And so if you're, what happened then is that lots of places or lots of departments, you know, played games. They looked at the vita of the faculty and said, okay, these are the top tier journals, and just wrote them down. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you know, what is the point of all of this? And maybe that was my problem. I didn't understand it. I thought this was a waste of time. And
you took it seriously instead of
as a
game
and
that
I
you
didn't,
could manipulate.
And I didn't really doctor the numbers. Maybe I should have done some of that. Well, no, I couldn't have. But this idea of peer review by other competing heads from competing departments is not a good idea.
Yeah.
And on this particular committee that apparently recommended to the dean that the program should be terminated, there were two heads from very competitive departments that really did directly compete with mine.
Oh my.
And I talked to the dean about this and was assured, of course, that everything was above board. And well, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really wasn't. But I don't want to rehash that. But the idea of individual departments making strategic plans is not a good one. It's a waste of time for the individual departments. I think the deans, what I understand mm-hmm. is the system here at Wisconsin, that the dean's office does mm-hmm. this with input clearly from the department. They have to know, but not that the deans say, all right, you tell us your goals, what hires you want, and then we'll tell you why you can't have it type of thing. And I think it's, in some comments I heard at this reception yesterday, indicated that, you know, the dean's office here had to make terribly hard choices, but that they got the respect. The dean's office got the respect also for having made these choices. And there wasn't, this sort of infighting among department administrators. I'm afraid that's what it comes down to at Penn State.
Frank is referring to the, there was a farewell party reception yesterday afternoon for Dean Certain, who is just retiring in a couple of months, that I also attended. It seems odd too that if you get more points or don't get points for publishing in German publications, even though they may be top tier, aren't you sort of infringing a little bit on academic? Aren't you kind of pushing people toward publishing in magazines that are in periodicals mm-hmm. that might not be the ideal ones for them?
Well, yes.
To keep the numbers up.
To keep the numbers up, and I just didn't do that. Yeah. I mean, and if people wish to publish in with German publishers. I mean, I know which are the very good German mm-hmm. publishers and which are the vanity presses, and I would say that.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, if someone publishes with a Berlin outfit, and that's looked upon in the dean's office as somehow substandard, not worth the University of Florida as much as the mm-hmm. University of Michigan Press, let's say, or something, I find that ridiculous. And I don't deal well with things like that. So I was glad to leave.
Yeah. Okay, I think we'll stop again. We may come back in a second, but for now we'll stop.